This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:05 in the evening, and our first story is actually about a dress code for work.
In order for workers to know how they should dress when they come to work, it's advisable that an employer has a dress code policy, and that this dress code policy is not unlawfully discriminatory to anyone. An employer may need to look at making what the law calls reasonable adjustments to any dress code policy so as not to discriminate against disabled workers. They may also need to bear in mind certain workers who wear clothing for religious reasons.
Specifically, the focus is on Muslim workers in the private sector, and the Human Resources Ministry has said that it's going to listen to views from the National Labour Advisory Council before implementing this dress code, and for that matter, before finalising the draft of what the dress code would cover.
As a refresher, this is coming after Datuk Mujahid Yusof Rawa, Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, announced in August last year that the government wants to work on this dress code to address possible instances of workplace discrimination. And this came up because his department had been receiving complaints from Muslim women working in airlines and service industries who had claimed that their employers were preventing them from wearing the tudung, citing the company code of conduct.
Here's an example of this sort of discrimination coming before the US Supreme Court in 2015.
Now we turn to the Supreme Court, where the justices today heard the case of a woman who went to a job interview wearing a headscarf and didn't get the job. But why? At the heart of the case, business rights versus religious freedom. As always, NewsHour contributor Marsha Coyle of National Law Journal was in the court today. How did this case get to the Supreme Court, Marsha?
Okay, well, Gwen, Title VII is our nation's major job bias law, and it prohibits discrimination on the basis of race. It actually makes it an unlawful employment practice for an employer to fail to reasonably accommodate religious beliefs or practices unless that would create an undue hardship on the business itself.
In this case, Abercrombie & Fitch, which kind of caters to the youth market and has a certain look,
yes,
said that her hijab, or the way she was dressed for this job interview, didn't match their look that they wanted that their employees to have. For more on the two sides of the argument, we turn to Munia Jabbar, a civil rights attorney, formerly of the Council on American Islamic Relations. What is an employer's responsibility, in your opinion, in this case?
An employer's responsibility is not to bury their head in the sand when they are on notice that a potential employee will need a reasonable accommodation from them to work for them. So, for example, in this case, there were supervisors' employees who recognized the young woman's headscarf as a hijab and that a hijab is a religious garment. Instead of engaging in a dialogue with her at all or asking her, do you think you're going to have any problems doing this job? Here is our look policy. They basically decided to avoid the issue altogether and not to extend her a job offer, even though otherwise she seemed to be a good candidate.
So coming back to our shores and the proposed Sharia-compliant dress code, back in August of last year, the Women's Aid Organization urged the government to stop policing what women wear, saying that the dress code could have the reverse effect, causing more discrimination for women who didn't conform to it, and that restricting what women wear is in and of itself discriminatory.
So that issue of discrimination is a tricky one, right? Because
yeah.
I think the response from Mujahid has similarly been, well, you know, the thing is, you say it's discriminatory, but I've been hearing about discrimination on the reverse side. And I feel as if, broadly speaking, a dress code does feel very restrictive because, you know, usually it means dress like this, don't wear this, do wear this. And in Malaysia especially, I think we've become accustomed to seeing dress codes being displayed as here's a series of ticks, here's a series of crosses, this is the yes, this is the no. And in that sense, it does feel very ugh. But I also believe that the discrimination is probably very real for people who are working on the front desks. I mean, whether it's flight attendants, I think the situation that was in August was of people kind of in
the staff at reception at hotels.
So yes, exactly.
Receptionists and also,
exactly.
And so
I understand that in those circumstances there might be that level of discrimination, but I'm just uncertain, you know, as to, it really comes down to what form the guidelines themselves will take. Are they going to be prescriptive? Are they going to say you must do this or you should do this, or is it going to be protective? Because if you're saying that it's supposed to eliminate discrimination, then it should be, you know, to protect and not to say this is proper and this is not.
I feel like the dress code isn't necessarily the best way to go around it, because, you know, like you said, if we introduce something that it's like just a series of this is what you can wear, this is what you should wear, okay, you look like this, you fit this, whatever. The problem there is that because the conversations and the discussions usually around what women wear are so dominated by men mostly, and then, you know, the men are the ones that are usually policing what women wear, and perhaps with this guideline, whether it's enforceable or not, it's still going to have that impact or effect in companies where, well, the government's guidelines say this, so you really shouldn't be wearing that anyway. So I think a better idea could perhaps be that just a simple ruling saying that you cannot discriminate what someone would wear for religious purposes.
Yeah. And however, I guess being Malaysia, I think we sometimes like things laid out more clearly. We always talk about that. But I'm really not sure. Let us know what you think about this issue of a Sharia compliant dress code for Muslim women working in the private sector. What do you think? Do you think that it is going to actually protect people against discrimination, or is it in and of itself discriminatory? You can WhatsApp us your thoughts, 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, it has, of course, in our next story, been almost a month since the smoking ban kicked in, so it seems as good a time as any to follow up on what's been going on.
Kerajaan yang lebih terbuka sekarang ni, yang lebih proaktif dan responsif kepada semua masyarakat, hendaklah sebenarnya memilih untuk engage ataupun berunding dengan semua pihak terlibat, termasuklah individu-individu perokok, bukan saja restoran-restoran perokok.
You might have heard some smokers protesting the ban, saying that it's eating into their rights, especially since smoking isn't a criminal act. Well, a group of 7 smokers, calling themselves supporters of the Protem Pertahankan Hak Perokok, also called the PHB or the Smokers' Rights Club, have obtained leave from the High Court to initiate a judicial review proceeding to challenge the smoking ban.
The court, however, didn't support their application for an order to suspend the ban, basically saying they don't have jurisdiction to suspend this decision that involves legal operation. But let's talk about where this Smokers' Rights Club is coming from. They're basically claiming that the smoking ban is a breach of the federal constitution because smoking isn't criminal, it's legally valid. Here's their lawyer, Hanif Khatri, explaining more.
Isu tentang hak perokok ni, dia bermula daripada fakta yang tidak boleh dinafikan bahawa tidak ada undang-undang yang menjadikan merokok itu jenayah. So, bila suatu aktiviti itu bukan sifat jenayah, maka pihak yang ingin melakukan aktiviti tersebut berhak untuk diberi peluang dan ruang untuk menjalankan aktiviti tersebut. So, itu adalah asas permulaan isu tentang hak perokok. Yang keduanya, kita semua tahu bahawa merokok ni walaupun dikatakan secara amnya sebagai tidak sihat, tapi sebab ianya tidak dijadikan jenayah, maka secara tak langsung kerajaan dan sistem pentadbiran daripada sebelum merdeka sehingga sekarang telah pun menggalakkan orang mengambil tabiat merokok. So, bila kerajaan telah menyumbang ke arah tersebut, maka segala langkah-langkah untuk memberi ruang dan luang membolehkan mereka menjalankan aktiviti tersebut selagi ia tidak bertindan atau tidak menghalang hak orang yang tidak merokok, hendaklah diimbangi.
They also stated that smokers have equal rights with non-smokers when they visit restaurants or other eateries, and that the government did not provide alternative locations for them to smoke, which is a form of discrimination.
So the end game here is they want to quash the health ministry's decision on the smoking ban, and they want a declaration that the enforcement was unconstitutional. Now, we've heard of, I don't think they were the smoking right club, so to speak, before, but you know, we have heard a lot of people saying kind of basically along these same lines that it's not criminal, you shouldn't treat us like we're criminals, that our rights matter as much as the rights of the other patrons of the restaurant. So I understand where they're coming from, but I think it's ridiculous. ridiculous, I have to say.
Yeah, I don't know. When they say they have equal rights with non-smokers when they visit restaurants, I feel like that's not necessarily equal in the sense that, well, non-smokers are not actively harming smokers in the sense that, you know, we're not a walking health hazard. Now.
Yesterday on the show, we spoke about how there seems to be a little bit of a mindset shift when it comes to discounts for summonses, basically, and how there seems to be an expectation that it's always going to be there. And then when it's taken away, it's like, why? Is it because the country is in debt and now you're taking money from me? And to just draw a line, it feels a little bit like that to me, this sense of, well, hey, you know, you need to support us. You need to give us alternative options of where to smoke. And the thing is, just don't smoke in the restaurant. Don't smoke within 3 feet of the... is it 3 feet?
3 feet.
3 feet, yeah. Don't smoke within that space and then you're fine, you know? So this idea that, like, hey, we are... It's an entitlement, I think. It's an entitlement mentality that I'm not fully understanding, or maybe I just can't understand. Let us know what you think about this push that has come through from the Smokers' Right Club to kind of declare this whole ban unconstitutional. What do you think about that? Let us know by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
You're listening to The Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. And first up, a quick correction. We were talking about the smoking ban earlier and kind of the distance from which you can smoke from eateries. And we sit at the time 3 feet. Dr. Kyrie Khalil has written in to say 3 meters, not 3 feet. Thank you so much. Because when I was saying it in my head, it was a tussle between, you know, 10 meters, 10 feet, 3 meters, 3 feet. So I think I was just doing the conversion and getting mixed up. So thank you for that. We've also been asking you for your thoughts about that in general. And Intan Sabrina says, well, you know, regarding the Smoking Rights Club saying that, I think Smoking Right Club, I keep saying rights, but it's the official title is Smoking Right Club.
Yeah, only one right.
Yes. And so they've, regarding what they've been saying about how it's not a crime and therefore they shouldn't be discriminated against, Intan Sabrina is saying, well, the government should make smoking a crime then.
Yeah, but they just don't want to be seen as criminals. And I think they're feeling sort of pressures, or maybe they've been receiving extra gazes from people, judgy gazes, perhaps.
Those judgy gazes existed before. It's just that there wasn't a ban. Owen says, about time Malaysian smokers joined the real world, for goodness sake. Michael says, then smokers should be denied lung cancer treatment. I think that's a bit of a harsh one, Michael. Nick Hasyudin says, if smokers inhale and swallow all the smoke, no problem. They have no rights to harm non-smokers. And we've got Julian saying, it could be argued that non-smokers reporting smokers and making them liable to fines and other penalties is being actively harmful to smokers. But I think it could also be argued that if you were to just follow the rules, then nobody's causing anybody harm if you were to just kind of do what you've been asked to do.
It's also not a huge habit shift. You just have to walk a further distance away to smoke. No one's actively asking... Well, I'm not saying that no one's actively asking you to stop smoking, but I think it's no one's actively preventing you from smoking except in spaces that you're not allowed to. And you still have a wide variety of spaces where you can, just not in restaurants, just not in certain parks, I believe.
Kik Wing Ho says, yes, it's unconstitutional because the government didn't consult all stakeholders first before coming up with the law. I'm not a smoker, but I'm looking at it from a neutral point of view.
Yeah, but the government doesn't necessarily consult us in everything. You know, if they had to consult us on this, on things like environmental laws or water safety, I don't think we could get anywhere or anything done.
Julian also said, rubbish, we don't need this kind of dress policing. And that was in reference to the Sharia compliant dress code that we're looking into instating for female workers, female Muslim workers in the private sector. We've been asking you for your thoughts on that as well. And we are still welcoming messages. Keep them coming. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet at BFM Radio. But we're going to move on to our next story, which is actually about finding investment opportunities. Basically, you know, just right in your own home. Everything is awesome. All right. right, you are welcome. We are also very sorry for getting that stuck in your head.
So it turns out that while you or your kids might be building towers and spaceships out of Lego, you might also be able to build your bank account. This is according to research that's found that Lego boasts an extremely high value when sold secondhand, with a higher rate of return than gold, bonds, and stocks.
This paper came from Russia's Higher School of Economics, and in it they studied 2,000 Lego sets that were released between 1980 to 2014, comparing their retail cost to how much they yield on the secondhand market from 2015. And it turns out that plenty of these Lego sets yielded a return rate of 11%, while others, you know, can go up as high as a whopping 613%.
So this means that Lego can be viewed as more than a toy, instead being a viable investment option, particularly because it's widely accessible, which in turn means that it can get overlooked and undervalued. Here's Jordan Hembro, Toy Hunter, explaining this world.
This is big business.
It is big business. Collectible toys are a multi-million dollar business, so we're talking about like a lot of money.
And is this the nostalgia factor? I mean, is that what drives this?
It absolutely is. It's nostalgia. It's that emotional connection that we all have to our childhood and, like, to our childhood toys, which is so great about the show because every time you watch, it's like this little warm, happy memory.
What are some of the biggest resellers, the toys that sell now just like they sold back then?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, a lot of the toys that are back in vogue right now are a lot of the toys that are attached to the major licenses like Star Wars, Batman. You know, when a new movie comes out again or when a new TV show is resurrected, the toys really skyrocket in value.
A lot of this value is coming from the audience of adult enthusiasts and a thriving secondhand market. Lego retires its sets every 2 years, and once they do, the value of the sets jumps significantly. And this is particularly true if the sets are from more popular franchises such as Harry Potter, Star Wars, or Marvel.
So some collectibles on eBay are listed with a value as high as $10,000 even, but of course that isn't the majority, and a lot of these Lego sets or figurines, you know, they're not, the value of it isn't exactly going to help pay off your house or, you know, for that matter, buy you a new one. But if you are thinking of getting into this, some tips. Here's the key to finding valuable Lego sets is to find vintage ones. And as we mentioned, to locate Lego themes that come with interest, you know, seasonal or movie themed ones. And also overall, they're more likely to be resold if they're sealed.
Also though, do you have enough room, time and patience to stock up on these sets and then wait for their value to go up? Do you really want to go deep into this world of Lego flippers? And are you ready to run the risk of this being another Beanie Baby bubble?
Yeah, because of course everybody remembers how, you know, everyone thought that it was going to be such a big opportunity. You have people who stocked up on these Beanie Babies, collecting, you know, these deeply valuable ones at the time. And now, of course, well, nobody, you know, is very, people aren't interested either in that market in general, nor are they actively kind of trading Beanie Babies or even treating it with that much interest anymore. I don't think Lego's going to go that way simply because it's such, it's got such history and legacy. It's been around for such a long time. And because it's built up such an incredibly loyal fan base over that period. But yeah, I do think that issue of space is a major one.
Yeah, I also think it wouldn't go that direction as, you know, say the McDonald's Happy Meals toys that I think at some point in time, people were selling Hello Kitty dolls from McDonald's for huge amounts of money. And with Lego, I think it's also because of the nature of the toy itself that you can kind of give life and breathe life into whatever it is you want to make. And that's why it, I think, essentially will always be timeless.
There are, however, other, you know, alternative investment opportunities that kind of have come along and entered the space. There are things like bags and watches, wine and art. But a lot of these kind of fall into a more luxury category as opposed to something like Lego, which makes it more accessible, I guess.
Yep.
But it all, every time I read about this, all I can think about is how, for me, it would take a lot of the joy out of things because you'd be buying it thinking about the value and not about the value of it to your life, you know, basically to the kind of happiness that it could bring you. Instead, you are kind of always planning for the future. And I don't know if that's how I want to look at my hobbies.
Or you could be doing both at the same time. You could be someone who buys two sets, one to play and build with and the other one to sell in the next maybe 10, 20 years.
Yes, I do know people who do that. Let us know. Are you interested in the Lego market as an investment opportunity? Are you already looking into these alternative forms of investment? We want to hear from you. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio. The messages have continued to come in about the Smoking Right Club. Rambling Mind saying, I fully support them. They have every right to smoke. Can I also sue every smoker within 3 meters of me for causing me cancer?
Oh.
that smoking is not a crime. The government did not stop smokers from smoking, just protecting the good for all non-smokers. Even countries like Thailand practice this. That came through from Sam Wing Kyung. Ping Chuan saying they should only be allowed to smoke inside their cars with windows up. A lot of active dislike, I think, coming the way of smokers here. And Jack says, can they start their own eateries just for smokers?
I think this health ministry isn't going to be, they aren't open to that idea. And back to the earlier message from Ping Chuan, who asked them to maybe smoke inside their cars with windows up. I think I've recently noticed that a lot more people are driving and smoking at the same time, or like they're driving and they have a group of smokers in the cars, windows down, smoking. I think that's usually the scene I observe post meal times.
And finally, this from Kushari Hashim saying, to be fair to everyone, a blanket ban is not exactly the way. The government should include a clause which still allows smokers to smoke, for example, in an allocated room, which is a suggestion that has come up before. In the meantime, though, we are headed to the news. But before that, a song. Here's You Don't Love Me by John Mayer on the Blues Breakers. This is BFM 89.9.
Become fabulous millionaires. BFM 89.9.
Well, we were also talking about Lego and how they're becoming a viable investment source. We were interested in learning some of the investments other people make, so we sent our interns out on the streets to find out.
Do you invest in anything, and what do you invest in?
I do invest. Stocks, exploring on properties, and I invest on myself, actually, personal development, not just the monetary investment.
So mutual funds and a little bit of equity and a little bit of bank deposits as well. Yeah.
I invest in unit trusts.
I invest sometimes in concert tickets, so if I know the artist is popular, I would buy the ticket and then wait last minute to resell it at a higher price.
I don't invest, and I never think about investing, mainly because I don't know anything about what to invest in and who to ask advice from.
Have you heard about alternative investments like Lego or wine? Do you think it has value?
I've personally never heard of investing in like Lego or wine, but I think it's a cool concept. If it works, then sure, go ahead.
I've heard about it, but I don't know enough to actually do it myself. I've heard about people who invest in wine or even things like art and have made like really good returns on it, but I think it's not for me.
It's the first time I've heard of Lego and wine as an investment. I would be willing to explore how valuable it would be long term, but it's the first time I'm hearing it, so curious about it.
I've heard of some stuff like this. Some of my friends are doing it, but I don't think it's a widely accepted form of investment among the regular Malaysian.
Where do you go to learn about investment opportunities?
Well, really, I'm a typical Asian. I just read the newspapers in some investment magazines, but that's only as far as I go.
Google search.
Probably ask my brother. He seems to know a lot.
Well, I read up online. I discuss it with friends. Yeah, I think that's mostly it.
Honestly, online forum is quite helpful, or there's like little events around town that you can always go to.
What's the best or worst investment tip you've ever received?
For concert tickets, if you buy it immediately, so like when it says this ticket is going to go out at 8 p.m., so you go at 7 p.m. on your computer, and then a week before the concert, you resell it at a high price.
Be conservative.
I think the best one I received was it helps to have, or it actually helps to pay a good financial advisor, because the money you pay them, you'll make many, many more times if you invest well. Worst investment tips is just keep your money safe in banks, I guess.
I guess the best tip is that I should invest because I don't do any investing.
Don't believe anything that's too good to be true. I think that's, and always listen and digest with a pinch of salt. That's my investment. We should always be cautious.
You just heard from some people about how and where they invest. Let us in on your tricks and secrets too. Text or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio and keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.